From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Arthur Miller, hailed as the greatest American playwright of the 20th century, died last night at his home in Connecticut. He was 89, master of the stage, champion of conscience. His plays were forceful, unyielding charges into the most challenging political and moral terrain of American life. To his last days, he believed in the real-world responsibility of theater and in the demand he placed on the dramatic arts to be fearlessly relevant to its moment.
You go to theater because it's giving you news of some kind that applies to today. And it's a rare thing that can outlast its moment.
Arthur Miller's greatest plays met their moment and outlasted it, from Death of a Salesman to The Crucible to The Price and More. The drama Miller brought to the stage was the drama of America's deepest, sometimes darkest self. Tonight on Point, the life, death, and art of an American theater titan, Arthur Miller. You can join the conversation. Is this a man who moved you? Do you remember the first time you saw Death of a Salesman, The Crucible? Were you knocked out by their moral, their political punch? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Cranston, Rhode Island, is Sue Abbotson, professor of drama at Rhode Island College and former president of the Arthur Miller Society. Sue Abbotson, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Sue Abbotson, we hope you'll take us into the biography of this man. I've been reading more than I ever knew today, and of course, now he's gone. But first, just your thoughts on what has passed with the passing of Arthur Miller.
Oh, it certainly is a great loss. I mean, even at 89, he was still a very vital artist. I mean, this month's Harper's Month magazine has a short story by him, and of course, they just finished doing the triads of his latest play, Finishing the Picture, out in Chicago.
That's incredible, at 89.
Yes, exactly. And it's and from what I hear, he had a closet at home full of unpublished manuscripts he was still working on.
He was battling cancer, pneumonia, heart condition, died in Connecticut with family and friends around him at his home, and his 34-year-old companion, painter Agnes Barley, at his bedside, where he wanted to be. He'd been in the hospital. He was out.
Yes, he was a very dignified man, and I think he died with dignity. He lived his life with dignity, and with his family, which I think has always been very important to him, although he's never liked to talk about his family connections. He's been a very private man all his life, always willing to discuss his work, his writing, to anybody, and on a very straightforward manner, too. But he liked to keep his private life private.
And a very feisty voice, right on through. Read in 2003, he was still talking about the responsibility of the dramatic arts of theater, chastising Broadway for having become a place of simply glorious, glamorous show business, saying, we can do better, we have to do better. He said, is this situation satisfactory for what purports to be the main stage of the richest country in human history? He clearly thought it had become something less than satisfactory.
Certainly. Not just the state of the arts, the state of the country as a whole. I mean, a lifelong Democrat, he's been always very outspoken politically, which I think differentiates him in some ways from some of those other American dramatic titans like O'Neill and Williams. Miller has always been very outspoken. His book On Politics and the Art of Acting sort of unites the two worlds in some ways, where he talks about the performances of presidents like Clinton and Bush. His insights have been fascinating. He's always been a firm believer, I think, in the ideal of American democracy. And I think it disappointed him that America hasn't lived up to that ideal, and he was always fighting to try and make America a better place.
He wrote in 2003, "Has the essence of America, its very nature, changed from benign democracy to imperium?" That's a tough question. Sue Abbotson, we're going to hear from Arthur Miller's work tonight. We'll hear soon from Harold Bloom, joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. But take us through the elements of his life. I didn't realize that he was joined to a very affluent family, or born to, in New York City. Began his life in a fine setting overlooking Central Park. His father, a manufacturer, chauffeur, driven to work every day before
That's
the Depression.
It, yes, up until his teens, when, of course, his father was heavily invested, as people were, in stocks. All his capital was in stocks. So when Wall Street crashed, his father's business pretty much went under. They had no capital left, and no one was buying coats as much either. So.
It was a coat. He made coats and did very well at it.
Yes, that's right.
What happened to the Miller family, Arthur Miller's life, when the Depression hit, when all that went away?
Well, I mean, Miller had been a bit like his character Biff Loman. It's a sort of the high school sporting star, not really very academic. And
a big, lanky guy, very physical.
Yes, yeah, and terrible transcripts. So he was thinking of going to college. His father couldn't afford to pay for it any longer. And he tried going to the New York City college for a short while, but realized it wasn't going to work. And he'd heard from a neighbor about University of Michigan, which was a bit getting a reputation as a radical enclave, but also fairly cheap if you could get there.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote to the dean, asked if he could get in, and they turned him down. But he was determined, so he sort of wrote again, pleading, saying, "I'm a changed man. I'll do whatever you need me to do." And they basically said, "Okay, you can come if you can get the money to pay for your tuition." And so he worked. He worked in an auto parts warehouse. He managed to get a job there, which was a bit of an eye-opener for him because he was one of the few Jewish guys working there. It was a fairly white Catholic environment, and that made him really aware, I think, of some of the anti-Semitism in America, which he's written about in a number of his plays.
So knocked out of his posh early youth into what it was Brooklyn and his family's straitened circumstances, off to Michigan, determined very early.
Yeah. Yes, a couple of years later, he managed to get there to Michigan. And, I mean, at this time, he had no real idea of being a playwright.
But he wanted to write, to tell stories.
He was a journalist, yes.
And how did he begin? How did he end up in 1949 with Death of a Salesman taking the country by storm?
Well, it was pretty much by his second year at the college, he was running out of money. So he realized they had the A.P. Hopwood Awards, which was annually given by the university, I believe they still are at the University of Michigan, and he realized if he could win one of those, he would have enough money to stay enrolled.
So become a prize-winning playwright and you can stay in college.
Sort of thing, and what he did was he wrote a play, perhaps not one of his better plays, originally called No Villain. He revised it a few times and had a little more success with it subsequent to that, but he basically, over his spring vacation, he wrote this play and won the prize for drama, giving him enough money to stay enrolled. And the next year he did the same, he pulled out the same thing and he wrote another play.
Within 2 years of his graduation, he'd written 6 plays, but he wasn't getting the kind of reception he wanted. 1940, married his college sweetheart, Mary Grace Slattery,
right.
First of three
marriages. Well, he hadn't had anything produced in any major theater. It was like the university theater, community theater.
He was doing it there. They had 2 children. He worked in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, wrote scripts for radio, and by the 40s gave himself, he said, a final shot at writing a really successful play, put everything into it. That was All My Sons.
Yes, he worked hard on that.
That got enough critical positive reception to keep him in the game. And then, of course, 1949 came Death of a Salesman. Let's hear just a clip from a 1965 performance of Death of a Salesman, produced by Arthur Miller, starring here Lee J. Cobb. A young Dustin Hoffman's here, Mildred Dunnock. In this scene, Willie Loman, Cobb, begs his young boss for a desk job that will bring his days on the road to an end.
I had $40 a week. That's all I need. $40, Howard.
Kid, I can't take blood from a stone.
Howard, the year Al Smith was nominated, your father came to me.
I've got to see some people.
I'm talking about your father. There were promises made across this desk. You mustn't tell me. You've got people to see. I put 35 years into this firm, Howard. And now I can't pay my insurance? You can't eat the orange and throw the peel away? Man isn't a piece of fruit.
Lee Cobb as Willie Loman in a 1965 performance of Death of a Salesman. There, the self-deluded, self-promoting, self-defeating soul of Willie Loman. Jack Beatty, you can hear there were promises made, he says across that desk, and you hear millions of American voices in that hard moment.
Yes, and you know, sometimes this is taken as an anti-business play, but the fact is that firm had been carrying him for years.
Mm.
You know, he's on there they've been tolerating him. Perhaps almost partly because Howard's father did make promises to him. And so it's not really anti-business. It's, in fact, the business is sort of charitable. It's finally they're saying, Willie, you've got to face reality. This isn't for you. We've just been supporting you. Every year you're earning less. And that's his tragedy. He can't face reality, face his own failure and who he really is.
Within a year of that play, the first meeting of Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe, his first marriage eventually went down. Marilyn Monroe, of course, became his wife. And how was that received, Sue Abbotson? I mean, talk about... I know Norman Mailer said, what was it, the country's greatest mind and greatest body fused here. Was it a celebrity marriage? It had to be. She was so big.
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty big, too. I mean, Death of a Salesman was huge. It was the only play, I think, ever to be put out as Book of the Month club for the club thing, but
11 million copies sold. Now it won the Pulitzer Prize, the Tony, everything that
year. I mean, he was known. He got Father of the Year award, I think, around in 1950. But certainly it was a very intriguing match, and I think it intrigued people, just two people they just never imagined getting together. And I mean, It's strange what it maybe had did to Miller's career, because obviously in the years when he was married to Monroe, he wrote very little outside of the movie Misfits.
But there was much more to come. We'll talk about with the Crucible, the McCarthy years, and all the rest. Sue Abbotson, please stick with us. Jack Beatty, we're talking tonight about the life, death, and art of the great American playwright Arthur Miller, dead last night at 89. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life, death, and art of the great American playwright Arthur Miller. He died at his Connecticut home last night. He was 89 years old. You can join our conversation tonight. Is this a man who moved you? Do you remember the first time you encountered Death of a Salesman, The Crucible? Were you knocked out by their moral, their political punch? Have we outgrown Willie Loman? Or is he still very much among us, out there on a shoeshine and a smile? Of course, after Death of a Salesman came The Crucible, Arthur Miller's answer to the McCarthy years and the grilling that he and many others took during that time, built around a retelling of the Salem witch trials, 1692. Here's a clip from the 1996 adaptation of The Crucible, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder. Here, John Proctor, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, is forced to sign a confession of witchcraft or face death by hanging.
I must have good and legal proof that you have confessed to witchcraft, Proctor.
You are the High Court. Your word is good enough. Tell them Proctor broke to his knees and wept like a woman. But my name I cannot sign.
Why? Do you mean to deny this confession when you are free?
I mean to deny nothing.
Then explain to me why you will
not... Because it is my name! Because I cannot have another in my life! Because I lie and sign myself to lies! Because I am not worth the dust on the feet of them you have hanged. I have given you my soul. Leave me my name!
Daniel Day-Lewis as John Proctor in the 1996 film adaptation of The Crucible. Talking tonight about the legacy of Arthur Miller. I've been joined by Sue Abbotson. She was president of the Arthur Miller Society. Joined us from Rhode Island College tonight. Jack Beatty's with us. We're joined right now from New Haven, Connecticut, by the great Harold Bloom, professor of humanities at Yale, on the faculty there since 1955. Many books of literary criticism and Western thought under his belt. His latest book is Where Shall Wisdom Be Found? He's written extensively on Arthur Miller's plays. Harold Bloom, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Your thoughts on the death of Arthur Miller?
Well, actually, when I first found out about it today, it wasn't a moment in any of the plays that came to mind. I remember a remark he made once in an interview in which he said that a man can get anywhere in this country on the basis of being liked, and without getting into our politics at this particular moment, it is a sentence that has, I think, considerable force.
You're thinking of political leadership in this country.
I'm not naming names, as it were. But, you know, I think when we start electing presidents simply because they are somehow liked or well-liked, and perhaps we are in graver difficulties than we even begin to realize.
Harold Bloom, I want to ask you, you are known for the value you put on great literature arising from spiritual sublimity and aesthetic intensity, qualities unrelated to politics or morality. Yet Arthur Miller's work is all about politics and morality. Where do you place him on that spectrum, from spiritual sublimity to gritty morality and political weight?
Well, I, of course, am not, I mean, like everyone else, I have personal politics, but I'm not usually very happy with political theater or political literature as such. Eric Bentley, a very considerable dramatic critic, perhaps the best dramatic critic still alive in the United States today, Eric has made the point that he doesn't think that in a play like The Crucible, the categories of the erotic on the one side and of the political on the other are clearly kept apart, and he finds this rather a difficulty in that drama. And rather more strongly, I recall Eric writing somewhere that In Death of a Salesman, which certainly remains and always will remain Miller's great achievement, there is an element of conflict between the social drama aspect of the play and the attempt on Miller's part to write tragedy. In one remark, which perhaps Miller rather dangerously made, he actually compared Willie Loman to King Lear, and of course, that's hardly fair to Loman or to Miller, because that would annihilate any other work. But one sees what he is getting at. I've always felt myself that perhaps the play should have been called Death of a Father rather than Death of a Salesman, and that the element in it, and also I think in the now underrated drama All My Sons, which I think is perhaps a more considerable work in the long run than The Crucible will prove to be, though of course in a country which still has as much overtly stated moral self-righteousness and moralizing of the worst kind, and mixing religion into politics and the state, which is what we are doing at the moment, The Crucible will retain a certain relevance, even if we are not witch-hunting on a grand scale these days. But in All My Sons, and even more in Death of a Salesman, or as I would call it, Death of a Father, the universal element that Miller does touch with, I think, enormous aesthetic dignity is the tragedy of fatherhood, it could be called, or the eternal struggle between fathers and sons. It is true that, as Bentley would argue, I think, there is a kind of impurity in the kind of drama that Miller wrote. He was profoundly influenced by Ibsen in particular, did himself a version, an adaptation of An Enemy of the People. He did not have anything like Ibsen's eloquence or Ibsen's extraordinary sense of tragic irony, but he has an astonishing pathos, I think, which, though not eloquent, is still amazingly lasting. I was recalling also today that, though I have seen several very fine performances of Willie Loman, by Lee J. Cobb and mm-hmm. by Abbie Hoffman and by others. The performance that has stayed with me is one that I saw, it was when I was a young man, back around 1952, I think it was. It was the very fine Yiddish actor Joseph Buloff, B-U-L-O-F-F. And I think he not only played Willie Loman, but I think he had helped translate, perhaps he himself was the translator, into Yiddish. As a play in Yiddish, it seemed to me, and of course that was my native language. I was born in the Bronx, but spoke no English until I was 5 years old, since we spoke Yiddish, you know. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that might be an element in this, but something really broke loose on the stage in Buloff's performance and Buloff's production of Death of a Salesman. It really did become Death of a Father. And if it did not take on Lear-like dimensions, nevertheless, it had tremendous emotional power. But, of course, the play properly performed, and I think All My Sons properly performed, does have extraordinary pathos. Indeed, one would have to say that whatever the, I suppose you could call them the impurities of his art, Kenneth Tynan once said that about Death of a Salesman, yet still there is no post-war play, that is to say, play written after the Second World War, yeah, pretty much going on. You would have to say for much the rest of the 20th century in English, no play that has quite the emotional drive and intensity of Death of a Salesman.
Whether with Lee J. Cobb there, or Dustin Hoffman, or Bolan. Jack Beatty, you can feel when you read, or most of all, see these plays performed, especially Death of a Salesman, exactly what Harold Bloom's talking about, where the political tragedy transcends, begins to touch a much deeper, fundamental human tragedy.
Well, the alliance, I think, between that he was trying for in his furthest reach in invoking King Lear, it was an authentic insight on Miller's part into Lear. I mean, Lear's tragedy is that he endlessly needs a bewildering excess of love, and he needs it from everyone, but most of all from the person he loves best, his daughter Cordelia. And his demands are so exorbitant, so extravagant, that in the deepest sense they are the cause of the tragedy. Loman, of course, is not built on that scale, is not meant to be built on such a scale, Loman indeed, but he also hungers and thirsts after familial love. He wants, above all else, to be loved.
Jack, join us here. A play in Willie Loman that starts in a very American setting and goes tremendously universal.
It really does. And to me, the line of Miller that sticks out in my memory is from a play called The Price. It's about two brothers. One brother becomes a Chicago cop pretty much to send the other brother to law school, as I remember. And the two brothers meet, I think, after the death of their father, and lots of bitterness about the sacrifices made. Mm. And one of the brothers talks about crossing Grant Park as a young man in Chicago in the early Depression, the Hoover years. And there are men with shoe shines and Homburg hats and coats and ties sleeping on the grass because they're homeless. And he looks at his brother and he said, "I realize there's no pity in the world." And I think that's sort of the offstage presence in a lot of these plays. There's no pity in the world. And in some sense, that's the political dimension, it seems to me. I don't think he's a political playwright in the sense of a Clifford Odets or someone like that, but there is this world outside where you can fall and fall absolutely, and there's no pity in the world is just there as an element, and it must have been there as an element in his biography because he fell. I mean, his father was very prosperous, and then suddenly they had to move from Manhattan to Brooklyn, lost their status. He had to go to work in a different milieu. Mm. There was no pity in the world.
And the echo coming right on through. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sue Abbotson, take us into that chapter of Arthur Miller's life, which was perhaps most political in the 1950s, when he ended up before the House Un-American Activities Committee in Washington. What took him there? Remind us of his performance there and how he came away from that trial.
Well, he was subpoenaed to testify and refused to name names.
This was in the sort of communist Red Scare, communist hunt.
This is it. I mean, he certainly had some liberal, borderline communist sympathies growing up, but had fairly early on realized that it was all about dogma and sort of rejected it. But he still didn't feel that, you know, one should go on. He just hated the way in which the committee was, like, asking for information they already knew and just discrediting people's lives. I mean, he wrote about, you know, he writes about that in other plays, like in After the Fall, where he has a couple of characters who are subpoenaed to go in front of the committee. And he himself really felt he should not. And, of course, his friend Delia Kazan named names, and there was a falling out between them because of that. He tells us in his autobiography, Time Bends, that the chair of the committee actually took him on one side and said, "We won't call you if you'll let me do a photograph opportunity with your wife Marilyn at the time."
Right.
Which he denied, of course.
But Marilyn Monroe nevertheless stepped forward, shielded him to some degree with her great celebrity.
Right. I mean, he was found in contempt, and he fought the charges, so he never actually had to spend any jail time, which some people did. But he certainly, I think, lost some possibilities. He blames that period with his not being able to get movies like The Hook made and other projects he'd been working on. And, I mean, obviously, he fought back somewhat with The Crucible, although he's looking again at he takes that broader view. He takes a specific thing, but then takes back and looks at the more universal view. I think it's one of the things that makes his play so interesting, the way in which he can explore the plight of the individual at the same time as the wider society.
Sue Abbotson, Harold Bloom, Jack, please stand by. I want to begin to invite our callers in. Melanie is calling from Cary, North Carolina. Hi, Melanie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
I just was taken by your comment about, you know, do you remember something in your early life about Arthur Miller? Arthur Miller has been part of my life since I've been a small child. My father was a child of immigrants in Chicago and very much taken with the Socialist Party, who then I think later became one of the leftist-leaning middle class in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. And I remember being 8 in 1958 or 57, around there. And my father took me to see a production in Los Angeles of The Crucible, and my mother was arguing with him. She's 8 years old. Why are you going to take her to see The Crucible? Because they had seen it.
And what did he say?
And he said, because this is America. And he was saying, I didn't understand it at the time, but it was part of a conversation where he said, this is America, where they can jail you because you won't name the name of somebody else, but also that you can write a play and tell everybody about it.
And
I remember, you know, this was the first real legitimate theater I ever saw, and it has stayed with me all these years.
A great way to start, an indelible message taken away there. Thanks to your father, I guess. Melanie, thanks for calling. Harold Bloom, we've just got a minute before the break. We've glanced off the cosmic, the universal here, but what about Arthur Miller's ultimate comment on American character? How would you sum it up?
Oh, it's a very interesting thing. I remember many years ago, Mary McCarthy saying that Willie Loman could not be Jewish because he had to be American. And I think that Miller, in a sense, understood that, but wanted to transcend it or get beyond it. It may be, you could say, I don't know if this is a negative remark, though, you could say that the only meaning that Willie Loman really conveys is the enormous pain that he suffers and the pain that, in turn, what happens to him causes us to suffer. Obviously, the meaning of Lear would go beyond that, but that's still, to be able to do what Miller has done there is no small thing. It certainly puts him in range with the major American dramatists of his own time and just before, that is to say, with Eugene O'Neill, Thornton Wilder, Tennessee Williams.
Harold Bloom, we've got to go at this point. I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. Harold Bloom, his latest book is Where Shall Wisdom Be Found? We're talking tonight about the late Arthur Miller. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life, death, and art of the great American playwright Arthur Miller, dead last night at 89. You can join the conversation. What were the odds of the Miller-Marilyn Monroe romance? How do you understand that relationship? What's happened to drama with the weight of Arthur Miller's? Can you picture a new Death of a Salesman on Broadway today up against the Lion King? What's the fundamental American truth that Arthur Miller revealed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear just a bit from Arthur Miller's screenplay, The Misfits, 1961 film. He wrote it when he was married to Marilyn Monroe. It starred Marilyn Monroe with Clark Gable and Eli Wallach, set against the brawling backdrop of a Reno rodeo. At the climax of the film, they've been roping wild horses, and Rosalind, Marilyn Monroe, suffers an emotional break that could cost her the only love she's known.
Murderers! You liar! All of you liars! You're only happy when you can see something die! Why don't you kill yourself and be happy? You and your God, country, freedom! I pity you! You're three dear, sweet, dead men!
She's crazy. They're all crazy. You try not to believe it because you need them. She's crazy. You struggle, you build, you try. You turn yourself inside out for them. But it's never enough. So they put the spurs to you. I know, I got the marks. I know this racket. I just forgot what I knew for a little while.
Marilyn Monroe losing it in Arthur Miller's 1961 film, The Misfits, and the men saying, you know, they put the spurs into you. These women, that is. We're talking tonight about Arthur Miller. He died at his Connecticut home. Last night he was 89. Sue Abbotson is with us. She's professor of drama at Rhode Island College, author of Understanding Death of a Salesman. Jack Beattie's with us. And we're joined right now from East Hampton, New York, by Marcia Norman, playwright, novelist. She knew Arthur Miller for the last 25 years of his life. She's the 1983 Pulitzer Prize winner for her play Night Mother. She also wrote the screenplay for the motion picture, won a Tony for her book and lyrics to the Broadway musical The Secret Garden. She's co-director of the Playwrights Program at Juilliard. Marcia Norman, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for giving me the chance to talk about him. We're just going to miss him so much.
Talk about him as
a real, like, human way.
Yes.
You know, we still have the plays, but
right.
We don't have him.
The human's gone. We all know the plays. Many fewer of us know him. Describe him as a presence, as a physical presence, as a personality.
Well, you know, I mean, it's easy. I mean, he was huge. He was handsome. He was funny. He was like the Marlboro Man. You know, I mean, he really. I say this because whenever they line up Pulitzer winners, as they used to do in the old days, he and I would be seated next to each other just because of alphabetical order.
Right, right.
And so that's actually how I know him, as the sort in this kind of like, okay, we're behind the banquet table forever, and here we are, and what do we talk about? And he had this magnetism to him that was, I mean, he was just this tall, sexy, handsome guy. And there was, I mean, yes, he could write. Yes, he knew about the theater. Yes, he had this instinct for what was American. But what a man. I mean, it was just astounding. I mean, I think, you know, this is the guy, I feel like, you know, he went up against both Joe McCarthy and Joe DiMaggio and won. this is a hero on some kind of huge scale in American life. He was to me. I mean, I knew him, you know, because of these long banquet tables with Pulitzer winners. But I also knew him because at the Dramatists Guild, where I'm vice president now, and where, I mean, dramatists in America are really under siege. Copyright is seriously in trouble in America. And he was one of the great champions of the idea of copyright, of the protection of authors' work, of this real need that we have as a nation to protect the tradition of the theater and the and the voice of the playwright and what, you know, so that aside from everything that he wrote, he had this political life and this life as a man that was just staggering.
I want to ask you about what seems to have been a remarkable capacity for passion or anger that lasted well into his 80s. Resurrection Blues came out just a couple of years ago. He was 86, and someone in the play asks, wouldn't you gladly resign from the human race if there was another one to belong to? 2003, he was writing, the bad part of being around a long time is the realization that mankind is endlessly rediscovering the wheel. He said, how many times do we have to indulge the same idiocies for which we must later be ashamed. Yeah. Could you feel that anger in Arthur Miller?
Well, actually, as in the human being, you didn't feel it. You didn't feel it standing beside him. I mean, I was with him the last time we went up to Washington together, all members of the Dramatists Guild and Arthur, just sort of looking for this. We have a cause up there, so we were up there all together. And standing beside him, he seemed to be like, you know, he could be carrying all of that anger. But it was not somewhere that you could see it. In other words, he didn't need to rage around and storm and be some kind of, you know, just grim, unpleasant being. You know, he was able to stand there and simply know how things were. I mean, what I feel about the plays, you know, is that he just identified, as your caller said earlier, what's American, you know?
Yeah.
Love of movie stars, the tendency to repeat terrible mistakes, the inability of fathers to ever meet the expectations of their sons, the inability of brothers, the inability, you know, the sort of the things that, the stuff that we love and the places where we screw up over and over and over again. And he was right. He just like went down the list of who we are as a people.
And
he just seemed to know it. And I think that there is a kind of, I don't know, sort of channeling thing that playwrights sometimes feel like things are coming through you and onto the paper and then onto the world. And, you know, he seemed as a human. I mean, often what he and I talked about at the banquet table was carpentry. You know, my brother is a big carpenter, and so we would sit and talk about, like, wax and varnish and, you know.
Okay.
You know,
he took a special delight in that. Maybe as a
table.
But as a Depression-era kid, he seemed to delight in taking on all the working class stuff, the tool belt around his waist.
Yeah, but you know what? I think what he did for the theater was to say, all the other plays are about the kings. We're writing about the people you never see in the plays, about the kings. We're writing about, I mean, you know, we're writing about the little guys, and they suffer in a huge way.
Marcia
and that, I think, is the extraordinary thing. That you felt sitting next to him, handsome eyes and hair and all of that.
I want to get our callers in here. So many want to join us. David's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, how are you tonight?
Great, thanks. What's on your mind, David?
I'm glad you played that bit from The Misfits, because I saw that movie again a few months ago, and it is a fantastic movie, and I really think it's the best thing he ever did or wrote, or more accurately, the best thing he was ever involved in.
And you know that scene that they're roping wild horses and sending them off to the glue factory, and Marilyn Monroe just loses it.
Right, but the great thing about that movie is that, you know, I think Arthur Miller had one limitation as a playwright, and I think it was a typically American limitation, which is that as a playwright, he liked to nail everything down. You know, everything, it was as though everything in his play was carefully numbered and cataloged, all the points he wanted to make. And, you know, he didn't have the quality of the greatest artist, you know, like a Shakespeare or a Beckett, which is what the greatest artist knew what to leave a mystery. You know, when you at the beginning of King Lear, you don't know why King Lear is losing his mind.
But you like The Misfit because he loosened up, he took off that didactic edge.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, the messiness of the movie making process forced him, just caused that the edge to be taken off that quality of his, and it made it a much greater, I think, ultimately, work of art, even though it was a collaboration with other people. There was all this real stuff happening in that movie. I mean,
absolutely, and we could hear it there. David, let us pick that up. Sue Abbotson, how about it? Arthur Miller's sense of his screenwriting work versus his work for the stage. David describes a kind of difference in the way he held them. How did he see the difference?
I'm not sure I actually buy that. I mean, one of the things I find delightful about Miller is his ambiguity in nearly all of his drama. I mean, he's often labeled as a realist. He wasn't. He hardly wrote a single realistic play, apart from maybe All My Sons. I think a lot of his more obscure pieces maybe are the ones when he was more experimental, just didn't make it into the public eye the same.
And what did he think of his work for Hollywood? Did he value it? Did he put it on the same plane as his stage work?
I certainly think he worked long and hard on The Misfits because it was his gift for Marilyn, and he wanted to give her something to challenge her as an actress. I mean, in some ways, obviously, the part of Rosalind, he put a lot of what he felt Marilyn was into that role. So how much of it was acting, I don't know. But I don't think he had some enjoyable film experiences, but I don't think he ever really saw film as immediate as the theater, as the stage. That's what his first love, certainly. I mean, he wrote in every form, but the theater was what he chose when he was back at the University of Michigan writing, and I think it was because of this more physical contact where the live actor rather than the screen actor somehow he just felt... And certainly, you know, if you've ever sat in a Miller play in the theater, you have a far more emotive response, than you would to a movie.
It is fully immediate. Mara's calling from Harwich, Massachusetts. Hi, Mara, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
As a theater professional, I think we're going to feel Miller's loss enormously.
How?
Because he wrote the big stories. And I don't think we get those anymore, you know. I'm in search of the new classics, and I don't know that we get those anymore. And I don't know if it's because we're so overwhelmed with fast media, but he took the time to write the big, deep, emotional things that you had to sit through for 2.5 hours before you got your payoff, and they're huge stories. They're deeply emotional, the little guy, and we all can feel that, and, you know, I think we're losing something in losing his voice.
Arthur Miller complained, Mara, about the theater of the bottom line. Of course, he had revivals of his work on Broadway, but can you imagine Arthur Miller-style theater on Broadway today?
I wish, you know. I'm working in the theater now, and I'm so saddened by everything being 2 and 3 actors in unit sets. You know, as a director, I'm desperate to put these big plays on stage, but financially, who can afford it?
And it's just not happening. Mara, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Marcia Norman, Arthur Miller said something I wanted to ask you to interpret for us, if you can. He said, a playwright lives in an occupied country. He's the enemy. And if you can't live like that, you don't stay. What does that mean? Let me give you a little more. He said it's tough. He's got to be able to take a whack. He's got to swallow bicycles and digest them. We need your interpretation.
Well, it just means that the potential for abuse as an artist in the theater is enormous and unlimited.
Abuse by whom?
Well, by everybody. By critics who wish they were you, you know.
He had no time for them. He said there were people who couldn't sing or dance.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that it's the most humbling occupation on the planet, because what you realize is that everybody has a story that they want to tell, and they think if they just were given a chance, they could tell it. And yet, you know, writing for the stage is like a kind of being an auto mechanic. It's not this sort of glorious lyricism of poetry or short stories or novels. I mean, it's a construction form. You know, it's what you have to make a piece of theater. It's more like a ski lift than anything else. It's a thing that you get in. You have to make the audience feel comfortable. You take them to the top. You let them out. You let them have the view, and then you let them go home. Do you know what I mean?
It's a process, and he's saying into enemy territory because you could be shot at any time on that ski lift.
Well, exactly. I mean, somebody can come in. You know, quite often happens that you'll get a great review from New York Magazine or from some magazine. The theater critic at that magazine will change, and suddenly the review that's in the back will change, and you will have gone from being a genius to being an idiot.
So you're not enemy territory. You're digesting the entire culture, and you'd better have a tough constitution doing that. Jason's calling from Goldsboro, North Carolina. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
Great. What's on your mind, Jason?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about Death of a Salesman. I first saw that maybe about 2 years ago in a college English class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone at first, when we first started watching it, no one was really taking it serious. But as it as it went on, you really started to see how the human spirit and soul can be broken. And it was an amazing performance. It was the Dustin Hoffman performance of Willie Loman.
Mm-hmm.
It was just fantastic.
Did it speak to your own experience, Jason? Could you relate directly to what was going on there?
Oh yeah, of course. And I agree with one of your previous callers about him writing about the little guy. And I mean, he told that story wonderfully about how society can, I guess in essence, stomp on the little guy and just crush him. And I think that was in Willie Loman's downfall. That, I mean, it was really conveyed amazingly.
And it hurt. Jason, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, I think so many people will have seen that play and identified with it, felt pain in watching that play that got incredibly deep. I know I did. It just got inside and touched my own experience, made me feel the dark, the bitter side, the tragic side that America doesn't dwell on.
Yes, and that seemed to be what he aimed at. He said, "I regard the theater as a serious business, one that makes or should make man more human, which is to say, less alone. That people could see in these plays aspects of their lives and aspects of all of our lives. That's the social dimension in Miller. There's a bigger proscenium. There's a bigger ambition. He's got society there. He's got America there. This isn't, you know, Sam Shepard's a fine writer and so on, but this just isn't Sam Shepard's father. This is something bigger." And that I think, is we're not alone when we look at these plays. We're there. And part of the buzz in our minds that we never formulate or see, he catches, he puts there.
Marcia Newman, we've just got a minute left. If a young playwright wants to pick up the torch of, laid down by Arthur Miller last night, what is that torch?
Well, I think what they have to do is to tell the stories that won't be told if they don't tell them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Don't just tell any ordinary old thing,
mm-hmm.
anything that happened to you today. Tell a story that absolutely will not get heard on earth unless you tell it. So that gives these, what we need are plays that have an urgency to them, have a necessity to them. You know, I mean, that's what he did. He told the stories that he thought, if I don't say this, nobody else is going to. And so that's what he did. That's why I grew up thinking that Willie Loman was my own personal dad, who was a salesman. I thought, oh, that's about my dad. And here I am today, you know, I'm a playwright and, you know, fellow on the path.
In the business. He told the stories. He told them big. Marcia Norman, we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Playwright Marcia Norman, she wrote Night Mother, won the Pulitzer Prize for that in 1983, co-director of the Playwrights Program at Juilliard, and Sue Abbotson at Rhode Island College. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Sue Abbotson, author of Understanding Death of a Salesman. Jack Beatty, great to have you along. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can read more about the life of Arthur Miller and his career at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.